Today on Esfera Life, we are going to speak to our guest, Freddie Silva, who is an expert on the phenomena of crop circles and their links to temples and sacred sites. Welcome, Freddie, to the show today.
Well, good morning.
Morning. Okay, let's begin by talking about ancient sacred sites and structures and how many of them started off as these primordial sites that evolved into structures. So can you begin by explaining the purpose of the ancient temples and what these sacred sites are all about?
There's a lot of ancient texts written in India, southern India specifically, and also in Egypt, which are basically they echo each other. And even as far afield as Central America, written on the walls of the temples, they talk about a time which preceded a global catastrophe, a huge flood, when it was a time of gods. This time is depicted as a time of a golden age when you know, people used to work for higher ideals. It sounds wonderful. It actually also sort of makes you want to be there.
Right.
And it was a time of places called the cities of knowledge, when these creator gods built these enormous temples as repositories of knowledge to do with the universe, to do with life, and also for the entraining of the soul, so that when people were living down here on Earth, they could actually transform themselves into gods as well. And it all kind of started a long, long, long time ago, even sort of beyond we can actually perceive, where the original sites of the temples, as deciphered by the Edfu texts, they talk about these special places on Earth that the gods marked as repositories of universal energy. And these were called the primordial mounds. And before these cities of knowledge were built, the mounds themselves were described as being built in a certain technological way by the kind of water that surrounded them that was different from ordinary water. It seemed to have been potentized. And these little mounds were held within this particular energy field, which then attracted what the Egyptians called the enemy snake. So, of course, the snake, of course, is the symbol and the euphemism for the telluric lines of the Earth, the magnetic lines of energy that flow around the Earth. And they talk about how before the temples could be constructed on these primordial mounds, they had to harness the enemy snake and actually make it sort of stay where it should be, and also dispel the negative parts of the snake so that any sort of discordant energies could be dispelled, and they would create these mounds where the energy was both unique to the site, but also it enabled a place where the weather was perfect, so to speak, so that whenever people built temples on these in later years, and of course this would evolve over thousands of years, whenever people walk into these special places, they would walk into a place of clarity. And it's something that is now scientifically validated, that whenever you do walk into temples, there is a definition between profane space and sacred space where the, you know, the known laws of physics are slightly altered in a way that actually do alter your brain waves and the way you also perceive the world around you. So that was their understanding of how to work with natural forces to get you to literally become a god.
So, I mean, what I study and teach is numerology. So how the sacred numerology or the sacred geometry, how did they determine these particular locations? Because they're scattered all over the planet. So in your study, is there anything that you've connected as to how they discerned where these certain sacred sites should be?
Well, it was rather interesting because, you know, the energy lines being what they are, you know, they behave like serpents. They move around relative to our thoughts, to the iron core of the planet. There's the way that the stars and planets revolve around us. All this influences the energy lines to move around as they do today. And so at first I thought that they would just basically go around the landscape like the Aborigines still do and literally feel their way for these energy hotspots. And then they would mark these spots with mounds. And over the course of time, they would build structures that we know and love today. And I thought that was the end of the matter. I then came across some research by Santayana and von Dekkend that talked about Heaven's Mill and the churning of the mill of heaven and how the earth revolves around a certain numerical value of years along its axis. And I wonder that if, since every temple in the world is a mirror and a correspondence of universal forces, I just wondered if somehow these temples weren't just haphazard. There was a certain ratio and a certain correspondence also to geometry on the ground. And what got me thinking was the fact that the Earth is unique for its living creatures. And, of course, if you study geometry and you observe nature, you'd understand that the pentagram holds the spiral of life that governs everything that's organic. Mm-hmm. And it was just a leap of logic. And I thought, well, I wonder if they would have aligned temples on the face of the Earth relative to a sort of a pentagonal grid. And I kind of left it at that because I then got involved with my first book and I kind of got sidetracked. And when I started researching the second book, it brought me back to that question. And at the time, I was researching geometry in general, and I came across the work of Graham Hancock, a good friend of mine. And he'd actually approached the same problem from a completely different point of view, because what I was looking at was if they had aligned the temples around the world to a certain grid, then if it was a pentagonal grid, they would have based it on the angles of the pentagram, which are, you know, 72, 108, 56, and all the derivatives of the number 72, essentially. Mm-hmm. The trouble was where to try and find zero. And if you just sort of use those numbers as longitudes, it actually began to work. And I found that Hancock had actually looked at the same puzzle, but from a different point of view. He'd actually looked at the Earth's precessional cycle, and he also realized that the numbers also fitted into that cycle. So we approached the same problem from completely different points of view and ended up in the same location, unknowns to each other. So the net result was that, yes, the major temples around the world and possibly some of the oldest sites on Earth are linked to each other by this sort of pentagonal processional grid of numbers, all based on the derivatives of the number 72. So let's say you're at the zero point of longitude, which is Giza, which essentially mm-hmm. divides all the land mass of the world into it's very similar portions. If you take any length of the number 72 as a longitude east or west of Giza, and you divide it by its into two all the way, you'll find that it hits exactly all the major power points of the face of the Earth. So we're not just talking about people who understood how to source subtle forces. They also understood that everything that was going to be constructed as future temples would have to be based on a correspondence of natural forces if they were going to influence the human body. So we're talking about an incredible spiritual technology.
Unbelievable when you think about it, because, I mean, this is thousands and thousands of years old. These energy lines have a tendency to move, and, you know, and when you take into consideration the precession of the equinox, it's just unbelievable that these sites, even today, thousands of years later, could have still holding this energy. And explain that a little bit more, because in my mind, when I see energies moving, but yet these places seem to hold that frequency.
Well, this is where the idea of the big stones came in, because it's always been a puzzle as to why people, like the Egyptians, they would build the core of the pyramids using rocks that came from 650 miles away. Mm-hmm. Stonehenge, they came from Preseli, which was over 140 miles away, and so forth. And a lot of archaeoastronomers have noted over the centuries that the stones seem to be doing far more than would be needed for an astronomical marker. It didn't make any sense. I mean, if you're going to basically make a temple where you are trying to figure out the positions of the stars over long periods of time, and they do that as on one level, mm-hmm. then it would have been easiest to put up a bunch of poles and be done with it. But no, right. They used some of the hardest rocks on Earth. They brought them from all the way around the world, and this is what got me interested in the principles that actually make up sacred space. And, you know, there are seven principles that underlie every temple. And one of them was the use of stone to anchor the energy lines. And suddenly the penny dropped, because when you look at the specific stones that we used, mm-hmm. each one of them is very high in quartz, which, of course, is a highly programmable stone. And okay. also we use this in radio sets. We use it in computers. You know, we're talking about silica here. Mm-hmm. And all of that is highly piezoelectric. That was the first clue. The second clue is that a lot of the stones also contain large amounts of magnetite, which, of course, would ally with the magnetic lines that they were working with, and also with the iron that flows through the veins of the human body.
Mm-hmm.
So when you put all of these things together and you now realize that intent, human intent, is an electromagnetic frequency, you begin to look at the myths of, that describe how the ancestors, then the creator gods, worked with their intent to program the stones to make sure that the lines would be acupunctured to the spot. And it makes absolute sense. If you can
right.
get a group of people that can just focus on the stone and say, right, we're putting in our intent into the stone to anchor this magnetic line of energy, it's mm-hmm. not going to move forever. And I believe it's a very elegant theory and a wonderful way to actually describe what the technology that they were doing.
I mean, it's brilliant. As we're, you know, the more you talk about it, the more you can just, it's almost awe-inspiring when you think about the connection with everything. But where did this information come from, this universal wisdom? Is there a certain dimension or level of awareness that has been, that this information has come from, that has been documented in some at some of these sites?
Ah, well, that's the mystery. that's the big mystery. I would gain the Nobel Prize if I could figure that one out. what we do know is that, let's just take the observation of the precession of the equinoxes and the mm-hmm. Earth's precessional field. That takes a minimum of 25,920 years of observation just to first of all realize that it's happening in the first place. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about huge spans of time here.
Mm-hmm.
We probably will never know where it originated from, but what we do know is that all around the world, and I'm talking at least 175 myths covered by cultures that supposedly had no connection with one another, they all talk about these very tall creator gods that lived before the flood. Sometimes up to 15 feet tall. I mean, there is an actual description in the Edfu building texts in Egypt
mm-hmm.
that describe the initiates as saying, that need to stand up with the gods who stand up. And these Ahau, as they used to call them, they were described as 9 cubits tall. That's about 15 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just stand back for a second and think about that, and then you look at the size of the temples, you think, well, you know, these temples would have been perfect for people who are actually a lot taller. But
mm-hmm.
they're not really built on a human scale. They're built on a superhuman scale.
Right.
These people, a lot of these people actually survived the flood because, again, we're told from the texts in southern India and also in Egypt that groups of 7 sages who were very tall, fair-skinned, they survived on various arks that were built by human people to survive this flood. And when they escaped from these arks, and not just one ark, many arks, all of these groups of 7 sages, their mission was to rebuild the former mansions of the gods. And
mm-hmm.
once they'd done that, they would then travel to the hinterlands and repromulgate the knowledge of the worlds of the gods so that the knowledge would be maintained for posterity. So we're talking about a group of adepts who survived this enormous cataclysm. And again, they were very, very tall people. And the net result of it is that when you actually look around the world, and specifically in the British Isles, these people are still buried there. And if you go to any good map in England and even Ireland, you'll see marked on these maps these enormous mounds called giant's graves. Now, I've been in these places because I used to live right next to some of them, and I've talked to many of the archaeologists, and they said that, yes, even during until the 1960s, they were still discovering skeletons 12 feet tall with elongated skulls being dug out of these graves. And because they didn't fit into the normal perception of how evolution should have happened,
right.
according to orthodox belief, the skeletons were mostly just disposed of and destroyed because they couldn't account for them. And yet, in the there's a magazine that was going around in 1895. It was called Strand Magazine, and I have actually secured a picture, which I put in my new book, of this fossilized giant that was actually dug up from a giant's grave. And he's about 12 to 15 foot tall, and they have him perched on the side of a rail cart in King's Cross Station in London. And you can see this, not just the skeleton, you can see the actual meat on the skeleton and the skin I mean, the guy is perfectly preserved, and he has a loincloth to preserve his dignity. And that's really it. And the story goes that the workers brought him over from Ireland to London to the Natural History Museum. Mm-hmm. And over the course of lunch, they went off and had a pint, and they came back, and the coffin is gone. It's vanished. And the same thing happened in North America as well. The Cherokee talk about coming into contact with a race of giants, people who, and I quote, escaped a deluge from an island that sank to an ocean to the east of Vickers a long time ago. And they met them up in the Appalachian Mountains. And these people were supposed to have created these gigantic mounds throughout the Ohio Valley, all the major earthworks in North America. And they were the dying race of these benevolent people and also creator gods. So by the time they got to know them, they, of course, were already dying off because they couldn't interbreed with anyone. So they called them the Alawani, which is where we get the American word Allegheny from. So even in our, it's in our culture. You just have to look for the information.
And it's fascinating that it's all at this time in our history is coming back again. All this information is coming up that's been suppressed for so long. Before we move on to some of the discussion on the crop circles, which this is going to go into, I just want you to explain a little bit about how these sacred sites and the sacred geometry, et cetera, help us to get into this heightened state of awareness.
It's about correspondence. The ancestors were great observers of nature and life, and they basically realized that everything is holographic. Whatever happens up in the universe also happens down on Earth, and it also is mirrored inside the human body, as we know today from science. You can find geometry at the very core of who we are as human beings. And one of the things that really got me to understand how these structures actually are able to transfigure the human soul, which is the prime reason for why they were built, was partly to do with the use of geometry. So what the ancestors did was to observe nature and see how different geometries worked in life and how the processes that they were involved with or described could be then transferred into the way that the structures were built. In other words, if you were building a temple and you were trying to work with feminine forces of life, with creativity, fertility, and so forth, naturally the geometry that undermines or underpins all of that is, of course, the pentagram. It's the geometry of organic life. And you'll find that every temple in the world that's associated with that, both through legend and myth, all the positioning of the altars, the pillars, the relative width of the walls, everything is accorded to the pentagram. It's the same thing with solar or masculine temples. These are, of course, processes which are the balance of the pentagram. They're all to do with construction and logic and rationality. If you look at the beehive, for example, it's based on the hexagonal values. Even when the light of the sun shines through water, you'd see it reflected back through the prism of water, and you see it coming up as a hexagram. So any temple that's to do with masculine principles, mm-hmm. and logic and rationality is always based on hexagrams. So each temple, therefore, will have a corresponding effect on the human body, and depending on what you're looking for. So if you want to go and connect with all that there is in the universe and the great mystery of life, you're going to get to the Great Pyramid of Giza because the slope angle is based on the seven-pointed star, which is a mystery unto itself because it's the only geometry that can't be divided into a whole number, just mm-hmm. like the soul can't be defined. So each temple had its specific corresponding effect on the human body. And here's the fun part. The predominant amount of geometries that exist, there are only seven which are considered sacred. And of those, there are two which appear again and again and again, more often than any other, in temples, cathedrals, into the energy fields that are exuded by every single temple in the world. And also, you'll find that these two geometries are based on the hexagram and the pentagram. And I always wanted to know why these two more than any other. And I was talking to a physicist at the University of London College of Medicine, and he said, well, you really need to look at biology and see how the human body is constructed, and especially its DNA, and that will give you the answer. And so I had to learn all this stuff from scratch, and I was looking into DNA, and I found that fundamentally, humans are based on little sugar crystals, which are bonded to each other in the patterns of the pentagram and the hexagram. So no wonder we have such a corresponding effect with those geometries, because they do have a very profound effect on us, and probably why the pentagram is such a pervasive geometry throughout all our systems of life. You know, we have five-star generals, five-star hotels, so on and so forth. It's almost hardwired into us. So when you go to a place like the Bent Pyramid in Egypt, for example, which many people will say, oh, it's just a mistake, but the Egyptians didn't build things by mistake. So this is all deliberate. If you look at the actual slope angles of the pyramid by using a very simple mathematical formula, you are able to extract the two angles that will bring you the hexagram and the pentagram from those two unique slopes of that pyramid. And that's why people have such a wonderful connection with that structure, because literally it is a mirror of the human body, and it's also a mirror of the two geometries that underpin the actual ratios of the way that the Earth works.
Amazing. I mean, when you start to connect all the dots, it's just, it's fascinating. The puzzle pieces, when you get one more and one more and one more, it just, the picture that it forms is just incredible. What I want to talk about now is just a little bit about these temples and sacred sites, because what happened with many of them was that they were taken over by the church. my second question to that would be that some of these places that were turned into Gothic cathedrals, for example, was the sacred geometry of the feminine maintained, or was it primarily masculine, the way these cathedrals were built? Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
It's a very complex subject in itself. I mean, you have to look at the reason why the Roman Catholic Church was created, and it was created basically as an arm of the dying Roman Empire to try and control people. And, of course, religion is a wonderful way to manipulate people, because it has nothing to do with faith, which is something that is far different and very, very important and everybody should have. And it's your own belief system. You know, what you believe is what is important. The important thing is to have respect for others and yourself. And you can't really go wrong with that. But, you know, around about the end of the Roman Empire, they created concocted this ridiculous idea called the Roman Catholic Church, which, you know, they stole bits from everybody else. They stole ideas from the Egyptians, the Celts, the pagans, the Muslims, and then they basically went around exterminating everybody and all the links to the origin of where they got the ideas from. And in my second book, I actually reiterate one of the most famous gaffes in history by, I believe it was Pope Leo the X, who claimed, and I quote, "This myth of Christ has served us well." And when you actually look at how the Templars and the Cathars, Bogomils and the Manichaeans and other sects at the time treated the Roman Catholic Church, they actually called it an imposter church. That they stole and appropriated the life, the myth of a dead man, in other words, Jesus Christ, whose doctrine these people were actually following to the true word of Christ. And so that's where the chasm really appeared. So if you cut a long story short and you get to the point where the church basically had exterminated all its competitors, and there were quite a lot of them and a lot of good ones at that, there was a lull in all of this killing. This is when Bernard of Clairvaux basically links up with nine knights and sends them off to Jerusalem to bring back a big secret, which they did. And suddenly, in the middle of a time period in Europe where you have, you know, war, famine and plague and mass unemployment, suddenly you have the erection of all of these beautiful early skyscrapers called the Gothic cathedrals. And if you look at the work of Bernard of Clairvaux, who was essentially the godfather of the Templars, you'll see the influence that he had over Rome. He was able to actually put in a pope under his own command, which enabled this information to actually be brought back. And the mystery of the Gothic cathedrals is that it follows on from the period of temple building, which had stopped for at least 800 years. because the conditions were so awful that anybody trying to practice ancient systems of knowledge was either decapitated, burned alive, or basically tortured to death.
Right.
So this is a rare period in time where the Templars were allowed to actually recreate the temples designed as Gothic cathedrals and built them on the ancient primordial mounds across Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And the beauty of these temples is that, yes, they are defined primarily by the pentagonal values of the divine feminine, because that's what it was all about. It wasn't just about women worshipping the divine feminine. It was about the masculine also honoring the divine feminine, because without that you have no life. It's a creative, fertile type of force. So in order to move things forward, they encoded some knowledge of all the values of temple building inside the fabric of Gothic cathedrals. And if you look at what the Russians were doing in the 1940s and 50s, they actually looked at this stuff and they said, well, what if it is true that the Templars did actually encode the principles of temple building into the Gothic cathedrals, which will allow people to have heightened states of consciousness and also healing, because people are saying that they have these experiences. And they actually did find that when they measured people's brainwave patterns in Gothic cathedrals, that your state of awareness goes up 4,000% above normal, which means that you develop a highly telepathic ability. So this is hard science now validating ancient temple building processes, and again reevaluating and also reestablishing the fact that the Gothic cathedrals was possibly the last moment of temple building that appeared in our modern era.
And it's fascinating that it all had to go underground, all this information had to go underground and be repressed at that time. And now that there's all this shift happening within the Catholic Church and within our society, so much of this information is coming up again. It's fantastic.
Oh, I think it's very I think it's very timely, because I think eventually the truth will come out. And it is being exposed for what it is, and this extremism that is happening is also helping to undermine the idea that the church is an imposter. They're not teaching anything that has anything to do with Jesus. I mean, if the guy was alive today, he'd be suing the church for completely, totally disregarded what he'd said, beginning with love thy neighbor, something that they hardly practice. So it's a huge hypocrisy. But that's not to confound the idea with the faith of Jesus and avatars like him, who were honestly they were pursuing the right course of action so that we can transfigure ourselves into better people, and that's what's worth keeping in mind.
Absolutely. Okay, from there we want to jump to crop circles. So can you talk a little bit, Freddie, about their importance and the connection to these sacred sites? Because I know that there is a connection. And the other thing I want you to talk about is, this is my question personally, are crop circles becoming more and more frequent? Because for the longest time we heard about them, and then in the last year or so, in North America anyway, we haven't heard much about them. So I'm wondering, has their frequency increased, diminished? What are you seeing? But what's the connection to the sacred sites? Let's start there.
It's a very tangible connection, and it didn't occur to me until I actually researched the crop circles first and then went back and looked at temples and realized I was really researching the same thing, that they just happened to be made in wheat and cereal crop rather than stone. Because every facet of temple building is actually found in the genuine crop circles. And we're talking about the manipulation of water, which, just like every sacred site in the world, they always reference water in some way, either nearby or beneath the building itself. The crop circles also appear at the crossroads of the Earth's intersecting lines of magnetic energy. They also undoubtedly are based on sacred geometry, whether it's hidden, which mostly it is, or whether it's overt, it's still there. There is a rich tradition in crop circles of people being healed inside them, or just by watching the images of them. And a lot of these people are actually skeptics, which is what makes the stories even more salivating. And of course, we also have the component of sound, which is how the crop circles actually are built. And of course, sound and frequency was a great element that resides in virtually every temple in the world, particularly ultrasound, which has been measured in stone circles as it has been done in crop circles as well. So when you actually put the crop circles in the context of temple building, and you go back at least 10,000 years, What I found was that there are periods of time when there are big jumps in temple building across the world, and each one of them precedes major catastrophes or major climatic changes. Mm-hmm. If I start around 3000 BC, there was a major temple building period that happened both in Egypt and also in South America and also throughout Europe. And within 150 years, you have meteorites hitting the Earth, major climatic shifts, great rises in sea level. It's as if they were trying to preserve the knowledge for future generations, so whatever happened on Earth, the knowledge would survive and people would know where to go when they'd forget that they too are gods. They're almost like self-help centers, if you think about it. The same thing happened around 2600 BC. Again, major build-up of temple building. All of a sudden, it's as if everybody diverted all of their resources to creating these incredible stone circles and the completion of Stonehenge as well. And again, within 120 years, the same things. Asteroids hit the Earth, climatic changes, major disruption of agriculture, again, rise in sea level. Same thing around 1300 BC, and incredibly, also, at the same time that the Gothic cathedrals are going up in 12th century Europe, and also the Angkor temples are going up in Cambodia at the same time, we then get hit with another meteorite, which was actually written by one of the monks at Canterbury Abbey in England, and that the Earth then experienced a mini ice age following that ended only in the 18th century. Mm-hmm. And so we come to the crop circles appearing at the end of the 20th century, although they have been appearing sporadically for several hundred years, as we know. But the biggest amount of crop circles appears at the end of the 20th century, built on exactly the same principles as the ancient temples. And again, we are experiencing major climatic shifts. We are certainly experiencing rise in sea levels. And there's one piece of information that was channeled 20 years ago by a woman in England who actually vectored, quite by accident, the source of the crop circles. All her information has been validated ever since. And one of the clues that told me that these temples are here to actually not just alter our human consciousness, but also to let us know of upcoming changes, is one of the paragraphs that she channeled on the trance said that these sites, these new temples, are supposed to be marked on the face of the Earth as the site of the new primordial mounds, which is a little bit sort of frightening and also very, the potential is huge when you think about it, which makes the whole debunking issue, of course, very prominent. Because if you try to mark on the face of the Earth the wrong places, then obviously we're in for a hard time. So in the crop circles, not only do we see a mirror and a continuation of the ancient temple building process, but also the potential for the future. We are supposed to learn something from this, mark these places, and also discover what's actually buried inside them. We have so far discovered new mathematical theorems. We have new systems of technology that we discovered from the crop circles. So they're not just being used as potential places to house the knowledge and make sure it survives, and maybe a precursor of coming catastrophes, I don't know. But we can be certain that they are here to obviously safeguard the knowledge for posterity. And the one thing that I am aware of that is going to be happening in exactly 134 years is that NASA has one particular asteroid in mind that it has a 1 in 10 chance of actually hitting the Earth. So is history repeating itself? Possibly. We're not going to be around to see it, but it's interesting that these things in time and over the course of millennia do have a pattern to them.
Well, I mean, I think there's patterns in everything, so you're absolutely right about that. But what I find fascinating in what you're telling us is that in the past, it seems humanity was engaged in building these sacred sites, these temples, these cathedrals. But in modern day, it seems we need outside stimulus to pay attention to some
exactly.
of these things. So,
you hit the nail right on the head there, because I mean, we have lost the idea of temple building. I mean, the Templars and the Freemasons who built the Gothic cathedrals and the kings of Angkor Wat in Cambodia, they were the last people who really understood what was going on. And, these structures survive. So we've completely lost the plot since then. So, of course, yes, some outside intervention is necessary to remind us of the magic and the connection that there is in the universe. And there's no doubt that people who have looked into the crop circles, and I'm talking about the genuine stuff, not the rubbish that's made by people, that's there, you know, there is something there, a great benefit, and it's opening us up to the bigger picture, absolutely.
Well, and the other thing is that these crop circles, from what I understand, are happening in specific points in the planet, but they may not be geographically, for example. I mean, I think when in the past some of these temples and buildings were built around community, were they not? And now we have these
The community actually built around the temple and the mound.
Okay.
Because the mound and the temple, the temple actually came much later. The original primordial mounds, which were mostly then supplanted by a standing stone or a central pole, they called them the navels of the earth, and that was where the effulgent energy of a creator god was housed. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, the buildings and the towns that evolved around that as the navel of the earth. And that happens in every single culture around the world. So the sacred center was where the temple really started, and then, of course, civilization goes around these sacred centers and evolves from there.
But in modern day, we're not having that experience, I guess,
exactly.
Is what I'm saying, because the crop circles, for one, don't last the same as a primordial temple or structure, and two, from what I understand, there's not people, they may pitch their tent for a few days or a little while around a crop circle, but they're not building communities around these particular spots. So I'm just trying to connect how we, or understand how we can work more effectively with this energy, given that, you know, in the past when there was an impetus to build many of these structures or mounds, it was because energetically they knew that there was a shift coming. How do we work with that energy today?
Oh, I think we work with community in terms of spirit. I think the rules have changed, and yes, you're right. We can't just go around building sacred sites as much as we'd like to, because you know, just the bureaucracy alone is ridiculous. Let alone the fact that we tend to, you know, there are a few cranes in the world that can actually lift 300-ton rocks. Let alone the amount of money that we would require to build something like a Stonehenge. I mean, it would cost billions in today's money. And then, of course, finding the land to do it and so forth. So the logistics are different. I think that what's been created is a spiritual community. People come around the crop circles in terms of spirit and like-mindedness, and then they go out and promulgate that information, and then they are the changes that they wish to see. So they live by example, or at least I hope they do. So we have to look at it from a slightly different point of view in context of today's culture. But the crop circles themselves, the physical portion of the circles, yes, it survives as long as the harvest comes around. But the energy of the crop circle stays in the ground up to 5 years after the actual physical crop circle has been cut down. And there is there's the rub, because those places I can go back with a pair of bent copper rods in the middle of England, or even here in North America, and I can locate the exact shape of the design from 5 years ago, because it's still there. And that's the beauty of these crop circles. It's not so much the physical that's important. The physical is just there to get our attention, to get us to, you know, to bring us to the sacred center, to attract our attention and our curiosity. It's what's in it that counts, and it's the same for a pyramid. It's the same for a stone circle. It's the space inside it that counts, because that's where the transfiguration takes place. And there's no doubt that when people go into the crop circles, there is a fundamental shift in their physiology and their psychology. If you are open to it, that is. If you're going there as a skeptic, then nothing's going to happen. It's like any good relationship. You have to approach it on a 50-50 basis before an interchange of information takes place. So anybody that goes to these places with an open mind, things will happen. The magic is going to happen. And then your life will change forever. And that's how I believe that the crop circles are influencing people, putting ideas into their heads and saying, well, how about this? How about a different way of looking at the world? And I believe that that's what is actually happening. And from what I've seen around the world from my travels, that people are implementing this shift very quietly. And you don't get to hear about it because good news rarely makes the news. You know, you have to have, you know, sex, violence, and all kinds of other stupidity to actually make the headlines these days. And just a cursory look at the upcoming elections in North America is a wonderful example of the craziness that's being engaged in. But yet behind that, there's people who are going about quietly doing the work of the temple builders, the circle makers, and slowly things are shifting. They are working through themselves and being an example that they wish to see. And I think others are magnetically gravitating towards those ideas, and slowly we will see some change. At least I hope so anyway.
Well, I agree with you. I think the only way that we can do, you know, work through this shift is one person at a time awakening and going out there and proselytizing doesn't seem to do any good anyway. You get locked up and they throw away the key. So
absolutely.
It seems to be the way we do things. But the crop circles, are you seeing them manifest or being created in specific areas? And what does that mean to you if it's more predominant, let's say, in the UK, for example?
The bulk of the phenomenon happened in southern Britain, and at the time I thought that it was all to do with the fact that there are so many ancient sacred sites still remaining there, and which is amazing for a little country with 60 million people in it, that the fact that we have so many thousands of sacred sites. And wherever the sacred sites appeared, there would be a crop circle beside them in some way, shape, or form. And I thought that was the end of that until then we began to get a lot of information from the North American Prairie, which sits on the same geology as southern Britain, and also the two sit on the world's deepest aquifers. And suddenly we realized it wasn't just a connection to ancient sacred sites, because, you know, they do also appear in the prairies, in the, you know, Saskatchewan, Dakota, Montana, or, you know, the whole area around the Midwest. There are a lot of ancient sacred sites that have since been cut down by the farmers. So that connection existed, but it was the connection to water that finally got the attention, because it seemed that wherever there are large deposits of underground water, the crop circles would appear on top. And when we began burying bottles of water in the crop circles to see what was happening energetically, we found that, yes, there's an imprinting of energy going into the water, which means, of course, that the whole world, when you think about how the water goes into the aquifer, then it goes into the rivers and streams and oceans, that energy is being diffused homeopathically. And, of course, we're all drinking this stuff. We're all being affected in some way, and it's getting us to open up. And just by watching what's going around the world, how everything is in a state of turmoil and chaos, I think it's having an effect. And you can't have a jump to another level of order unless you have some chaos in between. So the fact that this chaos is happening is actually a great sign. It shows that the plan is working, that we are thinking about the last 4,000 years of history and realizing that the experiment is done. It's over. We need a new level of thinking. So from that point, the crop circles achieved the original function. But since then, they've appeared in 29 countries around the world. And they seem to go wherever they're asked. Now, I often get asked, you know, like you're saying, is the energy getting stronger? Is there more frequency to them? There's actually less frequency now. A cursory look on the internet, and you'll see that every year there are, you know, 60 crop circles in England. But I can tell you, hand on heart, that the last 4 years, 5 years of crop circles in England, most of them have been actually made by people. There's a lot of hoaxing going on. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing. It was always a transmission. We knew this right from the start. The transmission had a beginning and it had an end and it had a purpose. And the bulk of that transmission has now been done. I mean, the last major genuine crop circle that I investigated was in 2003, and it was one hell of a crop circle as well. And you can actually see it on my website. And since then, I've noticed that there are many more genuine circles beginning to appear in North America. Not many, but enough. And it's the simple circles now that seem to carry all the energy of the real phenomenon. So there's a bit of a strange irony going on here, that just as we are beginning to figure out what it's all about, there's a lot of people going out there actually trying to ruin the whole phenomenon by posing, you know, man-made circles as the real thing, which, of course, they're not. So that's the truth of what is actually happening. The bulk of the transmission has been achieved. What the circle makers are now doing is fine-tuning the information by strategically placing, you know, a simple circle here, a simple circle there around the world, and just fine-tuning the energy that goes around the planet. Because when you think about it, if these things are happening on the Earth's magnetic lines of energy, it's like in the old days with cassette tape, and I hope our listeners remember cassette tapes. It's a very old 20th century technology. It's the same process. You're putting in a piece of sound, which is what the crop circles are based on a magnetic strip, and it only takes one to hit that magnetic strip for the whole world to read the tune. So it may seem from our point of view that, you know, there are fewer crop circles appearing today, and, you know, it's kind of sad. But it was never about a performance. You know, they're not doing this for a performance and to show off. They're doing this for a very deliberate and very important purpose. And it only takes one to hit the mark for the whole world to feel it, and we shouldn't lose sight of that.
Okay, and when you say they, I want you to explain who they are. But the other thing I want to say is that in your book, Secrets in the Field, I mean, you've got all kinds of fabulous pictures of crop circles there. And when I look at the perfection of the geometry, I can't imagine a human or a group of humans creating anything so perfect because it's such a huge scale. So I just want you to explain a bit from your perspective who they are and also the difference between the crop circles that are human created versus the energetically perfect ones that seem to come from the universe.
It's very simple, actually. The difference is that the genuine crop circles are an expression of energy that has been witnessed by 80 people coming down as a beam of light as far back as the Victorian era. Even policemen have seen these things. And this beam of light comes down, hits the earth, and there's a sound component inside it, and the shape is actually the expression of the sound wave that it carries. So if you look at the science of sound and how you, when you throw sound into liquid and you photograph it, you will get the same shapes as you will see in the crop circles. And this energy is lasting. It's electromagnetic as well. Mm-hmm. And it has an effect on the physiology of the actual plants with which it interacts. It changes their molecular structure. It changes their crystalline structure. It also changes the crystalline structure of the soil. And the one thing that differentiates the man-made from the real ones are that the real ones are not damaged at all. There's no physical imprint that actually takes place on the crop. The plants are bent about an inch above the soil without any damage, and they're practically hovering and spiraled in a perfect mathematical ratio. Hoaxes can't do that because of their nature, that they have to use a flattening piece of equipment. They damage the crop. But over the years, I mean, some of these groups have been going at it for over, you know, 15 years, and just like any monkey that tries to learn how to typewrite, eventually they're going to get it better and better. And a friend of mine said very prophetically that when my book came out, because I spilled the beans and all of this, and the problem with spilling all the beans is that you're also giving the enemy a chance to improve their work. And he said, you know, once this book comes out, the hoaxing is going to get a lot better. And funny enough, it has, because finally the hoaxers realize on a visual level what it takes to make a real crop circle. And so their work has improved in terms of the harmonics. They're also working in huge groups, sometimes up to 14 people, highly coordinated. And they've also been paying off the farmers, which means that when you're working on a piece of land that, A, is far away from human eyes, and in England you can get away, if you know where to go, you can get away from any kind of surveillance by people. Mm-hmm. And if you've got the farmers' permission to work by day and by night, and a lot of these supposedly complex designs, and believe me, the human ones are not as complex as they appear. They are quite easily explained. They just look complex, but they're not that difficult. So when you have that much time to work with and immunity from prosecution by the landowner, you can get a lot of work done. And I've seen a lot of these people create some very big designs with a lot of geometry in it. But when you actually sit down and examine it and dissect it, they're actually not that complex at all. They look like they are, but they really aren't. And ironically, some of the simplest genuine crop circles are much more complex than the most supposedly complex geometric designs made by humans. And another friend of mine once said, you know, if it takes me at least a week to figure out how it was made, it's genuine. If it takes me less than 3 minutes to work out the geometry, that's probably human-made. So that's the sort of the politics that goes on in the whole phenomenon. And you don't really get to hear much about this on the internet. But again, for me, as a researcher, I have to be very careful as to the information that I portray, because for me, it's not just about a passion. It's about trying to be true to the origin of the crop circles and the message that they're trying to do and the work that they're trying to bring. And for me to, you know, knowingly give out false information and, you know, get carried away for the sake of selling books or merchandise, it defeats the purpose of the exercise, because if we are supposed to be marking these special places on Earth as the sites of the new temples, then I have to be very careful about my information. So, and that's why I'm very clear about the man-made ones and also the genuine ones. So that's the human part out of the way. The origin, the true origin of the real crop circles, I always keep saying read chapter 13 of the book, because it's all in there, because mm-hmm. there's a lot of hard evidence to back this up. So to cut a very long story short, back in the early 80s, there was a friend of mine who's one of the world's best trance mediums, and the police often knock on her door to get information about missing people, bodies, and robberies and things, and she's got a near 100% record of looking at this stuff. So she's a very, very good channel. And one day, quite by accident, she happened to be vectoring the information about the origins of a specific temple in England when someone seemed to have crossed her wires and started telling her about that in 7 Earth days, there's a consciousness that would be appearing over the face of the Earth next to one of the temples in southern Britain, which would show their a message, and they would come in the shape of symbols, which would be working with the illusion of gravity, magnetism, and sound, which would act to alter the consciousness of humanity, prevent the Earth from going about its shift before its time, to give the Earth, to give people enough time to get their act together. And they basically were a response to a request that humanity had sent out into the universe for help to try and, you know, get things moving. So they were answering this request. And when we read over the transcripts, we basically looked at each other and said, "What the hell is this about?" we had no idea what these symbols at the base of the hill of Silbury were. And 7 days later, we drove there just to find out what was going on. And sure enough, that's when the first rash of crop circles appeared in the modern era. And that's when we realized what was going on, that there was a universal consciousness that called themselves the Watchers. Sometimes they described themselves as the Shining Ones. And they said that if you look at your history, you will find that we are referenced in many of your ancient texts. And we have come before many times in the past to help in the construction of sacred sites around the world. And sure enough, when you look at the transcripts of Egypt and the temple scripts, you'll find that the Shining Ones are mentioned as the Neter, as the creator gods who originally built the primordial mounds. So it seems to me that these guides, what we would call in Christianity archangels, have mm-hmm. returned in spirit to again help out humanity and try and bail us out. So they do appear throughout our history again and again. And they also stated that sometimes when they had the ability to incarnate, they would incarnate with according bodies, because their consciousness is so, the vibration of their consciousness is so expanded that in order to house that frequency, they had to build and create appropriate bodies for themselves. That means that they would have to build longer skulls. And of course, we have found a lot of people around the world buried in sacred mounds with elongated skulls. And they also said that they had to create larger bodies, which, of course, brings back the whole concept of the 15-foot gods who were responsible for creating the primordial mounds on which the temples now stand. So all this is coming back around again, I believe. We are seeing the return, for lack of a better word, of the creator gods, and the story is repeating itself again and again.
Which is fascinating to me, because when I think about, if we look at the Mayan calendar, and I follow Carl Kalman's work, and he's talking about moving into that final stage of the universal in March of 2011, the universal stage from his perspective is when we understand that we are created to forces within the universe, and that there's other energies that have impacted the Earth from the universe that have visited, whether you're talking about extraterrestrials or however you want to define them, but it's just fascinating how, again, we're weaving and connecting dots through this whole process. It's just amazing to me. So thank you, Freddie, for joining us today, and I want you to explain or give some information about your books. I have The Secrets in the Field. I look forward to reading your latest book, Commonwealth, but just talk a little bit about that and about what you're doing in the next little bit.
Commonwealth, which is the new book, it has a nice long subtitle, which is Our Legacy of Places of Power and the Transfiguration of the Soul, which you should never say after a few drinks. It's really the extension of Secrets in the Field, and in a way, almost backwards, because I began to research the crop circles ahead of sacred space and then realized that sacred space and crop circles are the same thing. So Commonwealth really is looking at our legacy of places of power and why they were built, and why this inheritance that that we have is so important right now, because we're all asking for help and salvation and empowerment. Well, the reason why these temples were built around the world was exactly for that, and that's why they lasted as long as they have, so that when we forget that we also are gods, we know the places where to go to get this information and connect with other levels of reality so that we can remember who we are. And once you remember who you are, then you are empowered, and then you don't fall for the usual crude little tricks that you have down here on planet Earth. And that's how you'll be able to basically live your life awake. And that's the best gift you can give to yourself. So that's just been released, and you can only get it from my website. And that's at invisibletemple.com. So go there, and I guarantee you, you'll be there for days.
Yeah, there's lots of information on there. And what about some of your speaking engagements? Because I know this fall you're doing a few.
Yeah, I'm sort of back out of my cave after 6 months of writing, and I've got a lecture tour schedule on there, which is being updated every couple of weeks as new things come online. A lot of stuff happening in New England, especially around Maine and Massachusetts, and then I'm going to be speaking in California at the Silliman at the ARE conference, and then Virginia Beach with the Edgar Cayce Foundation. And then Palm Springs coming up, I believe, in February. It's just about being announced, and also in Atlanta. And then sometime there will be a nice little trip to Egypt and also to the south of England. So if you want to have a look at where I'm going to be and if you want to join all those fun people, keep checking into the lecture schedule.
And we're going to work at getting you back to Halifax again.
Absolutely. I had a lot of great trips up there. I mean, I really had a great time with people up there, and I had no idea. I've always had a soft spot for Nova Scotia, and I never understood why. I've had it since I was a child, and it was just great being up there. So at some point, I'm sure I'll be back there again.
Well, there's a lot of Templar information here with Goosecap, so we're going to have to investigate that a little bit.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, thank you for joining us today on A Spiro Life, and I want to remember all the listeners, keep your energy flowing. Namaste.